figuring out what it takes to develop extraordinary systems, organizations, teams, and individuals is what I'm all about in my work with C-suite executives and entrepreneurs, and my research too. And inclusion and belonging have become central aspects of this work. Of course, if you want the best performance, you need everyone, yes, absolutely everyone, to give their very best. It might sound simple and intuitive, but actually it requires overcoming difficult blockers, obstacles in organisations and indeed our mindsets and practices to do this. Welcome to the Lancefield on the Line podcast. I'm your host, David Lancefield. In this episode, I talk to Ruchika Tulshyan, the author of the best-selling book Inclusion on Purpose, about how to do this. She talks candidly about what it takes to change the way we think and behave based on her extensive research and lived experiences. Specifically, we talk about how recruiters get it wrong when they talk about cultural fit, how to tackle biases across your organisation, what your responsibility is if you have privilege, how to practice allyship productively in different situations, and what it takes to ask the right questions of others, especially those who are different from you. Ruchika is incisive in her thinking, has a great turn of phrase, and is a wonderful conversationalist. And I do hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to you, Ruchika. I'm so looking forward to this conversation. You have so many accolades. I don't know where to start. Obviously, you are a former international business journalist. You are a multi-book author, but this is the most recent one. And I hold this up here, but frankly, I don't need the book because look behind you. You have the book Inclusion on Purpose, An Intersectional Approach to Creating a Culture of Belonging at Work, which is a lovely play on words, the main title, and the subtitle has some academic leaning. So you've got everything in that book. It's a bestseller. It's much acclaimed. And having read it and reread it, it is substantive. It's really well researched, full of lots of practical tools, frameworks. It's demanding to read as a white male privileged person, and it's much needed. You are also the CEO of your own consultancy, Canda, which is an inclusion strategy consultancy. I love that positioning and the branding again. And today we're going to be talking about creating, of course, that culture of inclusion, and very importantly, what gets in the way. We're going to challenge conventional wisdom and language, which is one of the things you pick up on many times in the book. And I quote you, we're going to look towards the sun, where there's more than enough light for us all to shine. Welcome to the show, Ruchika.
Thank you so much, David. And I will say one thing. I'm paying homage to my new home country, the United States, which I've actually lived in for over 10 years, with this giant poster of my book behind me, because this is very unlike myself, I will say, to promote my book. So
get comfortable with it. It looks great and it's a fantastic book. So let's start on talking about culture. It's a big theme in many organizations, particularly in the shift towards hybrid cultures. One of the things I've been writing about is how that's not linked enough to strategy, but that's not what we're going to talk about directly. Although the one thing I'd say about inclusion, at least in the organizations I know and worked with, is it's often separated. Mm. It's a separate topic, separate initiative, separate leader. Yet one of the main messages in your book is that it's absolutely fundamental. If you are one of those leaders in the C-suite and you are looking to evolve the culture, where do you start? What can you change to make sure that inclusion is right, a foundational element of any work on culture?
Yeah, David, thank you for this great question. And I want to start by saying, literally, that is what most organizations I feel today get wrong. And the organizations I consult with, I speak to, the leaders, and even various employees at various levels who are struggling to feel included and like they belong, talk to me about this challenge of there's this one person in one siloed part of the organization in charge of inclusion, when I really wish every single person who worked at this organization felt responsible for creating a more inclusive environment. So the first thing that I think any leader who really understands why, you know, you could be in charge of literally anything. You know, I have talked to medical health professionals, especially during the pandemic, doctors, anesthesiologists, I mean, literally across the board. I've talked to accountants, I've talked to lawyers. I feel very lucky that I've spoken to a group at NASA, and literally at every single organization, and no matter what your role is, you have an ability to be more inclusive. And how it starts is actually not thinking about change, but more starting with the awareness of where you're at right now. So for leaders, it could be as you know, simple, but most of us don't stop and take stock of where we are right now. What's the demographic makeup of our team? What was the demographics of the last five people we hired? If we're very senior, what is our succession plan like? Who are the five names, you know, that we would immediately turn to in terms of who we want to bring on and who we want to develop? Research shows, for example, even when we look at sponsorship, 3/4 of us sponsor and really groom. I know that word has, you know, some mixed connotation, but really whom we develop to replace us or to even work alongside us. 3/4 of us choose people with the same race and gender as us to sponsor. So it's really taking stock of those moments, really noticing how is our hiring process like here? If we're in the boardroom, how does someone get on the board at this organization here? How do we make those decisions? It really starts first there with that awareness and being able to ask those questions, reflect on that, before you even think about what change could look like.
And it's actually having the, I guess, moral compass and courage, well, not really courage, just doing it, actually stopping and pausing, rather than waiting for somebody to call it out, either in an individual in one of the not underrepresented, but underestimated groups. We may come onto that. As one consultancy found out, clearly not the one I used to work for, when they pitched with an all-white male team on a topic that included a series of topics that included diversity, the client said, just have a look at you. You don't need to get to those sort of shock moments. That's a pretty awful sort of thing. That requires having a look at yourself, having a look around, but also having a bit of a mindset of we need to grow differently. We need to grow ourselves. And you call that out both on the look at the organizational growth elements and you look at the individual in the different parts of the book. And you challenge the notion of, if you like, cultural fit, which is a term that's used all over the place. Tell me what you prefer and what make and leads you to that perspective.
Yes. I found the concept of cultural fit very honestly, just confusing and confounding, especially as someone who has lived in so many different countries and cities around the world. And it's really hard, actually, even today when people ask me, Ruchika, where do you fit in? The question or the answer is, I don't know. I'm not really sure. You know, I was born in Singapore, I identify as a Singaporean, but that doesn't mean that that's where I fit in necessarily, especially now living so much of my life outside of Singapore. So what I really encourage organizations and leaders to think about is how to create culture ad and how to hire for culture ad. Because what we find is in organizations where there's a very narrow definition of who fits in, there's obviously, you know, there's skills such as that we look at, you know, it could be, we're very analytical at this organization. So to fit in, you have to be very analytical. But inadvertently, and I know this is something that feels uncomfortable to talk about, what that often means is you need to look a certain way to fit into this organization. Yes. And that's why when we find, you know, I'll come in to speak with a new client and they'll say, you know, we have this real diversity hiring problem. The last 10 people we hired were all white, or the last 10 people we hired were all male. And, or they went to this very, you know, they went to only these 3 universities, for example, if we're talking about like early career hiring. And that really stems from this narrative of a culture fit that we have all been sold in corporate culture, and we really have to think differently because
it's a very static view of life, isn't it? It's a sort of, this is how we are. We'll still get on a stage somewhere and talk about diversity and inclusion. You're not a big fan of diversity, I agree, but inclusion and belonging. But then actually, this is the norm, and you'll sort of squeeze yourself into it. biases is something you cover. I mean, that's part of what we're talking about as well. Systemic and systematic biases in organizations. Mm. If you had to pick out one or two that you would call out as being the most pronounced and problematic, what would they be?
You know, the one that I think is what I've found in all the work I've done and all the different places I've even lived in is almost, you know, it's hard to quantify, but I'd say for me, it's like 9 out of 10 times. Most of the time when I meet people, it's really in good faith. Even when I encounter people who have said something to me, for example, you know, where are you from? Why is your name so strange? Even things like that. I really think it's never done in a way to hurt other people. Most of the time, it's not done in a nefarious way. And one of the challenges that I think we really fall prey to is affinity bias, which is actually very, or same as me bias is also another way that we call, you know, this bias. And it's a very, very, it makes perfect sense. We're hardwired to look for sameness. We're hardwired to feel connected to people who we believe have the same identities as us, right? Mm-hmm. And who have the same connections as us. Now, the challenge with that is it's totally fine. You know, I'm a Singaporean. There are very few of us around in the world. So when I meet another Singaporean, of course, I feel extremely excited. You know, we get into a great conversation. Mm-hmm. It's well and good for conversations and, you know, and even maybe to form a friendship. Where the challenge starts to become, where we start to see the challenge play out is in the workplace when people make decisions, sometimes completely unconsciously based on affinity bias, right? Like we went to the same university or we have the same, you know, you remind me of a younger me or you remind me of someone I am good friends with and therefore I feel a connection with you and therefore I'm going to make professional decisions based on affinity bias. And I think we don't realize how often this exists. And I just want to use an example, right? Like I sat in on a hiring, I've sat in on quite a few hiring loops over, you know, I've been fortunate to have that experience where I've sat in on hiring processes. And I'll hear things like, one candidate is selected over the other because we like the same sports teams, right? Now, unless, and this has actually happened to me, I was speaking somewhere and someone raised their hand and they said, well, you know, this example you used of us hiring because they liked our sports team. Well, we work for the sports team. We're part of the marketing department. And I said, okay, that is the one example where it is okay. It is part of the job to like the same sports team. But in every other example, absolutely, you know, making decisions.
That's a good get out.
That.
I mean, let's see if it was real. No, but that's a good. I mean, it's interesting. I've felt that on a smaller scale. I mean, I went to a non-selective, what we call here in the UK, a comprehensive school in a rural part of Dorset. Let's be super clear here. I'm still white, so I'm privileged. I'm now middle class, whatever you want to call that. But I have felt the same in an organization that was predominantly, you know, private school of a certain type of school. Now, did it have a material bearing on my progression? No, not to the same degree if I was a person of color, but I felt it a little bit.
Yes.
So I can only just imagine. But if you were somebody in a group that is more represented, like me in most cases, and you had the right inclination and you were thinking, look, something's got to change around here. It doesn't feel right, doesn't look right. We are not representative enough, let alone inclusive enough. Where do you start to learn about the experiences of others, about what you can personally do to make a contribution?
Yeah. Well, I think there's amazing literature out there, and I wouldn't, you know, as much as I have my book literally screaming from the rooftops behind me. One of the books that really, a couple come to mind. One is, of course, Caste by Isabel Wilkerson, who is a U.S. historian who has written an incredible book about how, and it really talks instead of about racism and, you know, or calling it sort of racial bias and racism, talks about caste discrimination and having like a very fixed place in society. You know, again, back to this fitting into society, how much we try and fit people into boxes in our society and categorize and really create a hierarchy, which we know is a false hierarchy. So her book is one that I highly recommend, both Inferior by Angela Saini and and Superior, also by Angela Saini, who, by the way, both her books are Sunday Times, highly recommended bestsellers. She's a British, science writer, and really talks about how we've used science and pseudoscience in many ways to justify gender bias in the world and in the workplace, certainly. And then Superior is specifically about racial bias and really the frightening return of race science to justify differences in society. So I think it's a good idea to take a very broad view of what we're really dealing with. Another suggestion I have in the book, another recommendation, which is research-backed, is really the importance of building empathy, which I think has become a big buzzword in our in leadership and management theory, which I'm really glad sometimes it's misunderstood. I think kind of like as diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging work, DEIB, became really popular, I would say, after the racial justice movement of 2020. But I've been in this field for a long time. There was a long time where I would come in and an organization would say, hey, could you not use the words, equity or inclusion or even diversity? Let's not talk about race if you're talking about diversity. I feel really fortunate we've come a really long way, but there are misunderstandings of what these phrases mean, and especially around empathy. Now, research shows by Dr. Jamil Zaki at Stanford that the more researchers that typically the more privilege you have, the less empathy you have. So you can imagine someone who's a leader. And I really use, in some of the speaking I do, I use this example of, if you are getting off a really long flight and you've flown first class, right? Your experience is going to be very different from someone who's had to sit right at the back of the plane, probably had to wait in a really long queue, had a much different experience, maybe didn't get, didn't have, food to eat until, or if they didn't plan ahead, all of this stuff. And I think what privilege does in many ways is, or talking very honestly and openly about privilege says, it may not be your fault that you have privilege. It may not be your fault that it's not your fault that you perhaps were able to afford first class or your company sponsored you to go on first class. And it's not my fault that I, for example, had to sit at the back of the plane, but it is your responsibility. The more privilege you have to have empathy for what the experiences might be of someone who didn't have that experience, right? And I'm using the plane example as one that I think most of us can, many of us listening to this podcast can definitely understand.
That's pretty radical, what you just described. I agree with it wholeheartedly, but I think it's a pretty radical, if you said to people, we need to be more empathetic if I'm more privileged. I mean, I think that would come as a shock to people. I mean, I've seen it firsthand with the treatment of my son, who's very disabled. And if I had to generalize, so this is not representative in terms of stats, but it's my one example, the people who are wealthier, more privileged in lots of ways are far, far less empathetic than people who have very little, very little. I see it day in, day out. So that's one data point, which sort of proves the theory, of course. But I agree with that. Let's just dig in further though, in terms of being an ally, because many white male leaders are encouraged, told to be a good ally, being a better ally. And this is not an excuse, what I'm going to say next, but there's something around, okay, fine. But what does that actually mean? So I've seen, for example, men in meetings intervene at times when, frankly, I get the meaning, but they shouldn't have done. The person could have dealt with it themselves. But their response was, I was being a good ally. So in general terms, how can somebody in a represented group, an overrepresented group, be a really good ally? Let's give some practical, let's get practical for a moment.
Practical. Now you're speaking my language. So David, a couple of things that I think is really important. I think the number one thing is when I talk about privilege in my own book as well, I certainly, I talk about the fact that I'm an immigrant, I'm a woman of color, I'm of Indian descent, I grew up in Singapore. But I also really want to focus very deeply about in the book and really in the work that I do about the privileges I have, right? I speak English, without any discernible accent. It's easy to understand. I speak it like my first language, although it isn't my first language. I've had top education, all of this good stuff.
Yes.
And I really think about what is my role as I have these privileges to ensure that I advocate for people and create opportunities for people to speak up on their own terms. You know, a big mistake, I think, in the privilege conversation is, you know, immediately you show up and because you have, you know, for example, you present as a white man, you know, you suddenly need to be shamed and blamed and, you know, there needs to be this target on your back. Where in actual fact, I think we can really have more honest conversations if we say privilege changes in certain contexts, right? And in certain situations, you know, I may have more privilege and in certain situations, I may have less privilege. So I think it is important for all of us who have been in any situation where we have influence, platform, and power to think about what is our privilege in that situation. It doesn't have to be, you know, there's only this one overrepresented group of people who we need to then shame and blame into doing things differently. I think we all have a responsibility. So that's one thing I want to say first. And then the second thing is really, if we think about practical tips, I'm going to say something a little more, hopefully, you know, maybe it can change our framing around ally, but I don't use ally as a noun. So I will never say that I am an ally. I try and say it as a verb. So when I think about ally, I think about practicing allyship, and I really think of it as action. Now, in situations where someone's tried to like swoop in and be the savior, that's definitely the opposite, you know. And even in those situations, I have more grace than someone who is observing bias in action, whose voice and influence carries because they have privilege in that situation, and they still sit back and say nothing, or they still sit back and let that situation unfolds until it gets really difficult and uncomfortable for the person at the receiving end. But I think of allyship as practicing action to create, again, more opportunity and to create more dignity for people who may not have the same privilege as you. And a way to do that is, part of it is developing that empathy. So really sitting in a situation, so I'm thinking of a meeting, maybe as a man, you know, research shows that even at the highest levels, even in the Supreme Court of the United States, female justices get interrupted at more than twice the rate of male justices when making an argument. So we know things like manterruption, which is, you know, a handy term, does exist. So the important thing in a situation like that is, if you see a colleague getting a female colleague and you identify as a man, you see a female colleague getting interrupted once or twice, you know, maybe in that situation, you give it a second and just see how is it playing out. You know, is this person being able to push back and get her message across again? If it's happening, you know, repeatedly and perhaps in a very aggressive manner, that's the moment where your allyship will really make a difference, right? You can, and it could be as simple as, I don't think Ruchika was done. I don't think she was done talking, or she was finished talking. You know, could we just listen to what she has to say? It could be a moment of, maybe in that moment you don't assert yourself if it's a one-off and then the moment passes, but perhaps you have a better relationship with the person who was interrupting me, right? In this situation, we're talking about me being interrupted. You would take them aside later and say, hey, this is a coaching moment and just wanted to let you know that I observed how you interrupted Ruchika a couple of times, and let's be more aware of that. So I think it's this idea of, rather than, you know, speaking for someone else, right? Rather than speaking for me, rather than David maybe saying, you know, you keep interrupting Ruchika. What she was trying to say is, you know, dot, dot, dot. Rather than that, all you're saying is, I don't think she's done, you know, talking. Let's let her finish, right? And then you hand the mic back to me. Yes. And those subtle differences can make all the change in that moment when it comes to practicing allyship.
That's brilliant. I mean, it's a lot about consciousness, isn't it? Consciousness of yourself, awareness of situations, and then being very skillful and, if you like, strategic, making the right choices about where and how to intervene, but not taking it from them. You know, they have their own brain, they can think themselves, but perhaps if you have a place to observe it, I think that's brilliant. Throughout the book, you have lots of brilliant, incisive questions. You have some hiring guidelines. I'm just giving you some hints for people to dive into the book if they haven't bought it already.
Thank you.
What would be the questions that somebody could ask, if you like, not just in calling it out, but what are the questions where you think, Dave, you know, if you only had to ask one or two questions in particular moments, those would be the ones that could perhaps break some inertia, break some biases. What would you call out?
I mean, for me, I always think about better feedback. And I know you and I are both a big fan of Miss Amy Gallo, who is a very dear friend of mine, really an expert on, you know, having even tough, difficult conversations. And of course, has a brand new book about working and getting along with difficult people. But I interviewed Amy for my book on, and especially around her expertise on feedback. And I just wonder what an amazing change it would be if more of us in our organizations learned how to give and receive better feedback. So one of the questions that I have in the book for leaders and managers, everyone you work with, and by the way, you know, my team actually has expanded a lot during the pandemic. I feel really lucky to be in this situation. And one of the things that can easily get away from you, even in your one-on-ones as you're having discussions, is questions like, what could I do to make this a more inclusive environment for you? What, you know, what's going well in our work together? What could I do differently? What should I learn? What should I get better at? And I think asking those questions with true curiosity, and sometimes the answer might make it difficult, right? It might be hard to hear what feedback you're gonna get, but it's about being comfortable with that discomfort and knowing that true change comes from that discomfort. The other thing that comes a lot to mind is the work around psychological safety by Dr. Amy Edmondson. And I think a lot about creating an inclusive environment, being one where people feel safe to speak up, take risks, and even fail. And research shows realistically, the more sort of further represented you are from the centers of power, the less likely you're going to feel comfortable and psychologically safe speaking up. So it's really also about, if we think about questions, it's, you know, what can I do to make sure that you feel heard here? Were there situations where you felt really included and like your voice was heard? Were there situations where you didn't feel that way? And what can I do as a manager and leader? And if we really think of our role as leaders, especially, to create opportunities for our people to be heard and really respected and like they belong, a big part of us is asking that question, what do you need from me? Because I think a big part of leadership to date has focused on, I'm going to tell you what you need. And what we're starting to see a change, you know, especially as I observe generations coming up behind me in the workplace, a big part of it is, here's what I need. I'm going to tell you what I need. Yes. Are you listening?
I think it's interesting. Everything you said there is about, as I said, being more skillful, in some cases doing less. So inclusion as a topic, as a practice, is not an add-on to the business or the organization for a skill set. It will be better for all of us. And it's interesting. I still think, and I'm going to say something controversial for the moment, so don't forgive me. Your brilliant work, for some people, the word inclusion doesn't work for them. Probably a number of white men I know, if I use the word inclusion, it has all the things I talked about as, labels and misconceptions and myths, wrongly, but it does for some people. If, however, I presented the work without inclusion and the practices and habits and so on, the end outcomes, I think they go, absolutely, that's a high performance culture. So there is work to do, and I think your work, your book and your wider practice makes a substantial contribution towards, well, we don't need to use the word inclusion. This is about high performing. Where organizations and individuals, where they can be themselves, as opposed to having to put a mask on or having to work harder. So I'm completely with you, and that's one I'm really interested in, because I think I've done things with good intent in the past, but done it for people. That's one of my personal failings. I've taken it from them, as opposed to that. But let's go back to you. This is not about me. You're the guest. Just going back to your own business, you said it's grown during the pandemic. I'm always curious about how people practice what they preach. So authors, speakers, and advisors. So what's the biggest change you've made in leading your business, having done the research and written the book?
Yeah, thank you. This is a great question. I had a quick thought as you were talking about leaders who, you know, maybe white men feel uncomfortable. Time and again, any interventions that I've introduced with my clients, with input, obviously, and driven by making sure that underestimated people, people of color, women, people with other underestimated identities feel like they should, you know, like they, that they belong. Time and again, when we go back and we survey even white men in the organization, they say these interventions really helped me feel seen and like I belong. So one of the ones that I can think of, speaking of being interrupted, is creating a culture where in one of the teams that we worked with, let's have a no interrupting culture, right? Like it's in the beginning, it's awkward. It's you know, people were interrupting each other all over the place. And then getting into that, well, over here, we don't interrupt each other. Okay, that's kind of awkward, but okay, let's play along. Let's continue down this path. And then 6 to 9 months later, creating a culture where truly people rarely interrupted each other because that was just now becoming part of the norm. And then going back and surveying people even who had felt overrepresented or who were demographically overrepresented, saying, you know, by making this happen, I'm, you know, I might be a, you know, straight white man, but I am also an introvert. And as an introvert, I feel more like I can speak up and I don't have to feel so worried about speaking up or just, you know, like I shouldn't speak up at this moment because I know I'm going to be interrupted. So I think what we forget is inclusion and creating a culture of belonging actually has benefits for everyone. And I, unfortunately, a big point. Part, it's very much been unfortunately talked about as like a zero-sum game, which it absolutely isn't. Now, in terms of what that has meant for me in my business at Candor is actually, for me, so much of this has been, as I grow the team, setting a vision and a mission, of course, setting a vision of this is what matters to me, this is what we believe in, the outcomes we're working towards, but then also letting people lead and be responsible for what they're responsible for. And for someone like me, it's challenging. My team is really diverse. We're truly made up, not only in terms of race and gender diversity, but also very much in terms of where people grew up and where what languages they speak. This is something that I really deeply believe in. So being able to create a culture where people both feel empowered to do what they do best and also give me feedback openly and honestly in a way that feels safe, right? And the way people have been socialized is different. And this is why sometimes a one-size-fits-all approach in organizations to feedback, to performance evaluations, et cetera, yes, is really detrimental because maybe I've been socialized in a culture where sitting in front of your boss and saying to them, you know, this thing that you do, it's not working for me, isn't something I'm comfortable with, right? And of course, research on gender bias shows, and then with the intersection of gender and racial bias, will show that, you know, I could very much be penalized for speaking so openly about giving, you know, especially critical feedback. So I think having multiple ways of delivering feedback, you know, some of the folks I work with, they really like to email me what's going on. Some of us we have one-on-ones with. And I think it's really getting to that stage of asking people, what's the best way for you to communicate with me? And then I will adjust as the leader, as a person who is running the organization, it's my job to adjust. You know what I mean? And I think that approach isn't conventional, traditional leadership, but it can make all the difference in making people feel empowered and then wanting to bring their best selves to work.
Is that the biggest change you've made personally in your leadership style? Flexing the way you interact and communicate with people?
Definitely, because I was a solopreneur for a very long time.
It was your way.
It was my way, for better or for worse.
So we always get a bit more personal, not too personal, I hasten to add, in the last few questions. And I ask the same questions to every guest. One is, in a nutshell, what is the impact you want to have on the world around you?
I want to render myself obsolete so that I can go and open, you know, a sparkling winery somewhere out, somewhere in the world. But truly, you know, I've, you know, you mentioned having a child. I have a 6-year-old son. My hope is by the time he's, you know, grown up and, you know, looking for jobs, he doesn't, these questions and, you know, situations we're dealing with today, like they seem so absurd, like, you know,
yes,
he can't even imagine it.
That's a brilliant way to frame it. And when you're doing your absolutely best, most brilliant work, what are the habits or practices that help you do that?
Asking for help when I need it, also something that's very difficult for me, you know, for a variety of different, you know, reasons, being an immigrant, all of that, truly fed into it. Asking for help when I need it, getting better at taking rest when I need it. I read this fabulous book a month ago called Rest is Resistance by Tricia Hersey. And really about how we need to push back against hustle culture, which again, as you know, as an entrepreneur, as a leader, can be very, very much part of how we operate. But for example, I was very unwell with the flu last week, and I'd worked really hard just to turn off and again say to my team, I'm really unwell. Please go do your thing. If you need time off, you take time off too. You know, we're not doing brain surgery here. We can push back deadlines.
Good for you, and I hope you're recovered now.
I am. Thank you.
Brilliant answers. One of the things that's refreshing, Rishika, is the fact that you reference other works, other authors and researchers, which is quite rare on this podcast and in life more generally. My other guests are now going to email me and say, "How dare you?" But it's true. We've covered.
I got you in trouble, David.
No, that's fine. I'm happy to be a troublemaker. That's part of my brand. I feel we've covered a lot of ground, but we also scratched the surface. But what I hope conversation has done is piqued people's interest, curiosity, and thirst for knowledge, and I guess an increased commitment to action. And of course, they've got to read your book, which let's guess what the title is. Oh, it's behind you. We can see what it is. Inclusion on Purpose. Rishika, that was a very stimulating, enjoyable, fun, and very important conversation. I'm very grateful for your time. So thank you.
Thank you.
That was another edition of Lancefield on the Line. I do hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do check out the other episodes in the series. Sign up to the YouTube channel and to the podcast. And by all means, give me a really nice rating. That will always help. Rishika, thank you ever so much again.
Thank you so much, David, for having me.